Welcome to Mars, a 12-part series on the fantasy of science in the American half-century, written and presented by Ken Hollings, with electronic sound production by Simon James. Part 1, 1947, Rebuilding Lemuria. Located on former agricultural land, midway between New York City and the munitions plants of Long Island, the first Levittown is open to the public in February 1947, offering affordable housing in the form of small, detached, single-family units made from prefabricated sections and standardized components. A planned community of 6,000 households, each situated 60 feet apart on their own patch of ground, it quickly expands to embrace a further 11,000 homes. Suburbia had begun to extend its grand conformity into space. This is a story of weird science, strange events, and even stranger beliefs. It is set in an age when the possibilities for human development had seemed almost limitless. During the course of the 1950s, the future was written about, discussed, and analyzed with such confidence that it took on an almost tangible presence. Especially in the United States, where an unprecedented economic boom, coupled with a growing sense of its own importance on the international stage, prompted Henry R. Luce, the founding father of Time Life, Inc., to speak with renewed vigor of the American century. And what boundless confidence do we hear in that term, American century? And it's helped along, not a little, by the fact that in 1947, the Truman Doctrine was announced, and the Marshall Plan went along with it, to influence and develop a far more aggressive foreign policy between America and the rest of the world. But there's an even greater sense of confidence in that term, a millennial sense of confidence. One that, if you like, comes out of a failure to make any distinction between a sense of material progress, going great guns in the immediate post-war years, and a sense of human evolution or development. In fact, they were confused to the point where they seemed interchangeable. And out of this matched discrepancy, a notion of science emerged in which it became more of a fantasy, a plaything for the human imagination. And history itself became a grand cosmological scheme in which humanity played a central, pivotal part. And what's unusual about this era, this American century, is the confidence with which the future is discussed. And I use the word confidence not in the sense of merely the optimism with which, say, the notion of vacationing on Mars, jetpacks, moving elevators, robot servants, etc., were extolled in this period, but it also includes the darker vision of what tomorrow would bring. It's Mars, the red planet, the communist menace, the vision of a world that's now just radioactive ruins, lorded over by a race of superintelligent robotic radioactive ants. And these views go together hand in hand, evolution and progress, pessimism and optimism. And they meet in a very interesting way within the newly emergent American suburbs, particularly in the purlieus of Levittown, by those munitions plants in Long Island. Because at first glance, the suburbs offer cheap housing to people who want to move out of the cities to get a little space and a little light and a little land that they can call their own, a front door that's theirs. And that's no bad thing. But it's shadowed by something darker. William Levitt and Sons, the company responsible for creating Levittown, actually developed the technique of using prefabricated units and mass-produced identical components in the creation of identical houses from fulfilling contracts for the US Army during the Second World War. Stranger still is the fact that the arrangement of houses in Levittown, which was on a very uniform grid with everyone having the same amount of lawn, the same amount of frontage, the same picture windows, was derived from the Oak Ridge community in Tennessee, an artificial community created there to house the technicians and scientists working on the Manhattan Project during the Second World War. And there's something else again in that grid, which of course has no place in nature. It's a colonizing principle, the grid. That it spreads out your resources, it spreads out humanity in a way that the tightly packed urban developments of the 19th and early 20th century didn't do. It becomes, in fact, the first line of defense against warfare that was going to take place increasingly in the skies. The suburbs actually exist under the shadow of death from above, aerial warfare, as had been seen in the last years of the Second World War. And then there's another aspect to the suburbs which is important to our studies. And it's this, that it offered up an isolated community of individuals, far from their normal patterns of life, trying desperately to re-establish themselves in this grid, in this expanse of nature that had been corrected by Levitt and his partners. And they can be tested and observed in two ways. First of all, the suburban living room becomes the repository of a large amount of new technology in the form of telephones, televisions, remote control units, hi-fis, air conditioning units, etc. There's an audio-visual laboratory begins to be constructed out in the suburbs. And at the same time, these isolated families, these isolated communities rediscovering themselves become an ideal test subject for a growing number of social scientists, anthropologists, psychiatrists, etc., to study in some considerable detail. More interestingly still, when we think about this strange conurbation emerging under the shadow of aerial warfare, under the shadow of the bomb, it's worth remembering that also in 1947, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists starts the nuclear clock ticking. This is the clock which indicates how near we are to nuclear annihilation, with its minute hand creeping nearer and nearer and nearer to midnight. And in 1947 too, it was the first year in which carbon dating was used to accurately determine the age of historical artifacts. Not an unimportant thing in an age when people still believed in the ruins of Atlantis, in the mythical existence of Lemuria. In fact, historical fact almost strengthened these myths. And so we have in Levittown our own Lemuria laid out under a descending wave of destruction, hanging over them, ready to fall at any second.
Thank you.
despite the dark promise of destruction that 1947 seemed to bring in its wake, it was still a year of marvels, a time of miracles. It offered, for example, the first dawning, if you will, of an age of push-button living, which of course was just perfect for the suburbs. 1947 is in fact the year when the first Polaroid land camera was put on public display in New York. And military contractors Raytheon invent the very first microwave oven, which was going to be a great standby for suburban living in the future. On a broader plane, however, there's even greater, grander designs at work, and the beginnings of what would be termed military-industrial reality begins to assemble itself in 1947. This is the year when the National Securities Act creates the Department of Defense, separates the United States Air Force away from the American Army. It's also the year in which the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, gets its charter, and we'll be hearing a lot from them over the course of these shows, I assure you. We also find that the Atomic Energy Commission is set up, and the RAND Corporation moves into its new complex of offices in Santa Monica, California. Now, the RAND Corporation had been around since very late 1945. It was a semi-private think tank which offered the opportunity to designers, engineers, planners, strategists, etc., to think outside of the box as far as what the future might entail. And one of their very, very first papers, one of their first declarations, was a remarkable document called Preliminary Design of an Experimental World-Circling Spaceship. One of the contributors to this paper, a guy called James Lipp, laid down not only the strategy for space, but in a sense the strategy for development progress as it would be understood during the course of the 1950s. He wrote, "Since mastery of the elements is a reliable index of material progress, the nation which first makes significant achievements in space travel will be acknowledged as the world leader in both military and scientific techniques. To visualize the impact on the world, one could imagine the consternation and admiration that would be felt here if the United States were to discover suddenly that some other nation had already put up a successful satellite." Well, we'll pass over the feelings of admiration at the moment and concentrate just very briefly on the notion of the mastery of the elements being a reliable index of material progress. And there you have, in its crudest terms, human evolution and material progress co-joined in this grand strategy that is beginning to take shape. In 1947, the RAND Corporation put together an interesting conference in New York where they started to invite sociologists, anthropologists, psychologists, etc., to come and talk to them about thinking processes. These, of course, would be the same social scientists that were busy licking their pencils and staring over at Levittown to see what strange, hopeful monsters might be emerging from those front doors. But it helped them define more closely what it was that they wanted to do. If you wanted products, if you wanted a microwave oven, you wanted a Polaroid camera, you didn't come to the RAND Corporation. You went to the RAND Corporation for what the acronym in their name stands for, research and development. And they said they were specifically interested in systems and ways of doing things, rather than particular devices, particular instrumentalities, particular weapons. And we are concerned not merely with the physical aspects of those systems, but with the human behaviour side as well. And boy, were they going to get a lot of human behaviour to play with in 1947. Because it was in the summer of that year that a civilian pilot and businessman, Kenneth Arnold, saw nine strange devices flying over Mount Rainier in Washington. "They flew like a saucer would if you skipped it across water," he said of his sighting to an Oregon newspaper man, allowing the term flying saucer to first enter the public mind through the print media, which is interesting in itself. What's interesting about Arnold's account is that the actual objects that he saw were actually sort of more sort of scimitar shaped. They were kind of a lot more pointy and aggressive looking than we might automatically associate with flying saucers. And it's actually the motion that becomes the shape in the description. It's the skimming motion that seems important. But it wasn't long until other accounts of flying saucers began to be appearing in the nation's press, mostly on a local level, but occasionally it would spill over into the national, even in the international press. For example, a few days after the Arnold sighting, it was reported that a flying saucer had actually crashed near an airbase in Roswell, New Mexico. The airbase was a significant one because it housed most of America's Strategic Air Command nuclear tactical forces at that point. In fact, it was the airbase from which the Enola Gay had taken off on its bombing mission to Hiroshima. Initially, there were some scary headlines from the United States Air Force saying they had actually recovered a crashed saucer and possibly some occupants. But this was quickly reversed within 2 days, and they went for the slightly less exciting revelation that it could well have been a weather balloon. Either way, the flap itself only lasted a couple of days. But there was certainly some strange things in the wind on the west coast of America at that time, because it's worth recalling that it was during that summer as well that in Hollister, California, a biker riot erupted. It was a strange, savage, drunken weekend in which the legend of the outlaw biker first established itself in the public imagination. These were mostly ex-service men who were trying to sort of regain some of the excitement, some of the lust for death and destruction that they'd experienced during the Second World War by basically getting drunk and riding around town in an aggressive manner. We'll be hearing more from them as well. Things were also hotting up on the other side of the United States, on the East Coast, in Long Island, actually, not too far away from Levittown, where more breathless accounts of strange, discoid-shaped flying objects were coming in. In this case, it was a slightly more humble piece of technology. It was the US Navy's Flying Flapjack, an attempt to create an early form of vertical takeoff plane that would also be capable of quite rapid forward motion. It hovers like a helicopter. Will it fly faster than the speed of sound? Interesting question in 1947 when Chuck Yeager had just gone through the sound barrier for the first time. Unfortunately, the Flying Flapjack, which looked like an ordinary plane had accidentally swallowed a dinner plate, was powered by propellers. It was very much a mechanical device. And that, I think, is where the real appeal of Arnold's flying saucer comes in. Because 1947 is also the year in which the first ever transistor prototype is tested at the Bell Laboratories. This would be the basic component of what would become the electronic age, the age that would very much endanger the print media world, which had first carried the stories of flying saucers. And what was interesting about those flying saucers was that they didn't seem to have any immediately apparent power source. They didn't need jet engines. They didn't need propellers. They weren't mechanical things at all. They belonged in the air. They belonged to an intangible level or order of energy and of being, which brought into play the invisibility of rays, of beams, of light itself. And now we maybe begin to see that that humble microwave isn't quite so humble after all.
It's the little battle with the magic wick that kills unpleasant odors, whether fish, cabbage, onions, cauliflower, or from burned foods. And of course, in the living room, Air Wick keeps the odor of stale tobacco smoke out of upholstery and draperies. And you know, Air Wick is so simple to use, it's like magic. There's nothing to light and nothing to spray. Just uncap the bottle and pull up the wick. Ask your dealer for Air Wick, A-I-R-W-I-C-K.
Kills odors, kills odors, kills odors.
Call me Einstein, Flash Gordon, or just plain crazy, I know what I saw. That's what Kenneth Arnold said about his sighting, and that statement pretty much sets up the mood for the next 10 years or so. Let's leave aside the Einstein and the just plain crazy part for a moment and concentrate on Flash Gordon, one of the great pulp heroes of science fiction literature in the United States. And there's a great deal of Flash Gordon around. We should possibly remember that the last Universal horror film came out in 1945. They stopped making them after that. And it'll be a while before science fiction movies begin to start turning up in the local cinemas. But there's still a big audience for science fiction visions, for pulp imaginings. And one of the most potent of those imaginings was provided by Amazing Stories magazine, who, at the very time when Kenneth Arnold was reporting his sighting over Mount Rainier, was dedicating an entire issue to the imaginings, thoughts, and memories of a man called Richard Shaver. We don't really have enough time to go into great detail about Richard Shaver, but it's enough to say that thanks to Amazing Stories and its equally amazing editor, Ray Palmer, Shaver had managed to convince a quite large readership for the magazine that had originally introduced Buck Rogers to the reading public of the country to the notion that the occupants, the inhabitants of Lemuria, the last remnants of Atlantis, were still at work on the planet. And not only that, they were beneath our feet, busily getting their grubby little claws into every aspect of our life. Now, of course, they were a sort of sad, demented relic of their once noble cosmological ancestors. They were called Deiros, which stood for detrimental robots. And Palmer had presented Shaver's accounts as being true. This is because Shaver had noticed that every time he put the words Lemuria or Atlantis on the cover, sales shot up. And thanks to Shaver's memories, the sales of Amazing Stories had leapt from about 25,000 copies per issue to 250,000 copies per issue, prompting the all-Shaver issue that came out at the same time as Arnold is talking about his flying discs. You can imagine how quickly Palmer got to work with those sightings. Well, of course, this was evidence of the Deiros at work in their malignant fashion. And we have some very potent myths brought together. We have the notion of a lost city, a lost continent, a civilization that's disappeared, and then the notion of this subterranean existence. After all, a large part of the Earth was crawling out from beneath the surface of the planet following the devastation of the Second World War. Of course, that also leaves the question of whether or not Shaver was crazy, which takes us to the third part of Arnold's statement, and the comforting discovery that the very first research paper on LSD was published in 1947. Not only that, but Sandoz Laboratories, who'd been busy studying and working with Dr. Albert Hofmann's discovery, decided now was the time to market it and make it commercially available for the first time. They gave it a brand name. It was called Delicid. And along with that brand name came a promise that Delicid was good for you. It was great for treating schizophrenia, alcoholism, and sexual deviancy. Three things that the sociologists would be studying amongst the occupants of suburbia. And that last one, sexual deviancy, boy, that was going to be a bit of a headache in 47, because right at the end of the year, at a psychiatric convention in Chicago, the very first copies of Sexual Response in the Human Male, the first study by Alfred Kinsey of American sexual behavior, went on sale. And at the same time, Kinsey established the Kinsey Institute for furthering this research. And it provided some fairly disturbing and unsavory reading for those who got hold of the book. It certainly implied that there wasn't a clean sheet left in the entire continent. And it was interesting for the first time to see mass behaviour, in this case, numbers of orgasms produced in any specific period of time, being fed through adding machines, through computers. Kinsey's very interesting for that. He didn't like telephones, he didn't like talking on the radio, something with which I have a certain degree of sympathy. But he did like adding machines and he did like computers. And for the first time, human behaviour, intimate behaviour, was being processed in this manner. And to cap it all off, 1947, thinking about the behaviour of the human male, 1947 is the year in which Wernher von Braun, German rocket scientist, cooling his heels as a prisoner of peace in White Plains, New Mexico, decides to marry his 18-year-old cousin. And what an order is coming into place, the man who will one day present us with the moon, out there in White Plains in the rocket testing fields. At a time when over on the other side of the world, another order is coming to an end in the form of an old, tired, worn-out junkie by the name of Aleister Crowley, who died in a Hastings boarding house in 1947. In the last months of his life, he'd been corresponding with an individual in Pasadena, California, called Jack Parsons, who was a rocket scientist and also a part-time occultist, who had been conspiring with a recently discharged naval serviceman called L. Ron Hubbard to carry out a magical process which would have created, if it had gone well, a moonchild, which would have been the next evolutionary order of the human species. It didn't go too well. What initially brought Parsons and Hubbard together was a love of science fiction and pulp publishing of that kind, and they parted on very bad terms. Crowley was actually quite dubious about their intentions and indeed their results. But what a time for the old boy to leave the stage. A man who was vilified as the wickedest man on earth. The man who was known for taking large quantities of strange drugs, disappearing off the stage at a time when the strangest of all drugs was making its entrance. A man who performed the rites of Pan in whorehouses and bathhouses and bedrooms around the world, suddenly finding himself in much larger and more civilized company than perhaps he had initially imagined. And also a man who was presiding over the creation of a moon child, disappearing in an age when the man who would bring us the moon is getting married. And in that moment, perhaps, we can pause and reflect and maybe just for a moment be one of those suburbanites standing on their patch of lawn outside their Levitt Town house over in Long Island. And we can look out onto that grid, onto that expanse of regular housing, of nature corrected, of new social and mental and sexual and psychological orders coming into being. And we can look at that and we can say, yes, I can see Lemuria. It has been rebuilt for me. Welcome to Mars was written and presented by Ken Hollings. Electronic sound production and live studio engineering were by Simon James. This has been a Project Thrust production. Project Thrust, the name you can trust.